from Turtle Island to Palestine. Occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Several United Nations agencies, including the World Food Programme, say Israel's bombardment of Gaza could lead to a famine throughout the entire Gaza Strip within 6 months unless immediate action is taken. Hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians are now in Rafah, and many are waiting in line for hours for small amounts of food as aid agencies struggle to meet the demand.
I came here to get food. I've been here since 9 a.m. just to get a plateful of food, because this situation is very difficult. We are from Gaza City, and we came to Rafah. The people of Rafah received us and welcomed us. But the numbers are large, and the situation is very difficult. There is no money to buy food, and there is no flour. We have no money to buy anything at home. There is no gas or anything that would help us to cook even a plate of lentils. We come here to get this plate of food, and it is not enough.
This comes as hundreds of trucks trying to bring aid to Gaza are backed up for miles in Egypt at the Rafah border crossing and have been forced to wait for weeks to enter. On Tuesday, British Foreign Secretary David Cameron urged Israel to lift barriers on delivering humanitarian aid into Gaza, citing, quote, real widespread hunger. Cameron was cross-examined by the Scottish MP Brendan O'Hara.
2 or 3 minutes ago, in answer a reply to the chair, you said, and I quote, one of the things we'd like the Israelis to do is switch the water back on. Now, that says that they turned it off. It says that you recognise they have the power to turn it on. Therefore, isn't turning water off and having the ability to turn it back on but choosing not to, isn't that a breach of international humanitarian law?
It's just something they ought to do, in my opinion.
No, of course they should do it. Every human being would say you don't cut people's water supply off. But I'm asking you, in your position as Foreign Secretary, point of international humanitarian law, if Israel have the power to turn the water back on that they turned off, surely that is a flagrant breach of international humanitarian law.
Well, I'm not a lawyer. My view is they ought to switch it on because the north of Gaza, the conflict is now effectively over there, and so getting more water and power into northern Gaza would be a very good thing to do. You don't have to be a lawyer to make a judgment about that. You just have to be a human being.
Last month, the UN Security Council passed a resolution to immediately increase aid deliveries in Gaza, and Human Rights Watch accused Israel of using starvation as a method of warfare, which violates international humanitarian law. Well, for more, we're going to Tel Aviv. We're joined by Sarit Mikhaeli, International Advocacy Lead for the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, which has just published a new report, Israel is Starving Gaza, that says starvation is, quote, not a byproduct of war, but a direct result of Israel's declared policy. Sarit, welcome to Democracy Now! Lay out exactly what you found and what you feel can be done about it.
Well, in very basic terms, almost everyone in Gaza is hungry almost all of the time. 2.3 million people are surviving mostly on sometimes one meal a day, people skipping meals in order to feed their children, people busy constantly looking for the next meal, for the next source of food for them and their families and children. And all of this is happening in a place that is pretty much an hour's drive from here, right, where it's supplying humanitarian assistance and food and all the necessities like water and other things that people rely on should not be a difficult problem. We're not talking about some sort of remote region internationally. We're talking about an area that is accessible, where the things that impede this provision of food for people who are starving is a declared policy by Israel. The fact that Israel isn't allowing enough trucks in the fact that Israel isn't providing the ability, logistical infrastructure to actually drive this food into Gaza in through places where it's possible to do, and many other decisions taken by the Israeli government that are impacting this, that are making it making the amount of assistance that is coming into Gaza simply a fraction of what the population need. And Amy, you quoted the international experts on this issue. Within a month, they expect almost all of the residents of the Gaza Strip to be up to what is phase three of this scale of horror, of hunger. And this is simply unacceptable when it's very clearly preventable. And the things that said in the British Parliament by Minister Cameron are very clearly a clarification that this is the result of Israeli policies and actions. This is not just some sort of coincidence or just some unfortunate byproduct of war.
Well, Sarit, I wanted to ask you, how is Israel controlling the food supply, especially in Rafah, where Rafah leads into Egypt? So how exactly does it manage to continue to prevent trucks from getting in?
So, Juan, let's even look at the past situation. I mean, Gaza was on the brink of collapse even before this war began with the horrific October 7th attack by Hamas against Israelis, right? So this has been a situation of food insecurity since the beginning of the Israeli blockade on Gaza, almost 17 years ago. But the Israeli decisions to cut off electricity, to cut off the water supply that Israel sells Gaza, to not allow all of the movement of the international humanitarian provision of supplies, those decisions made it almost impossible from the start for even bakeries to operate and provide for the people. And now what so the collapse was very quick and based on a very long period of deprivation. But now the issue really is that there needs to be hundreds of trucks entering Gaza every day, and just a fraction of that is entering. This is happening because Gaza, the Rafah crossing is just not equipped for the movement of goods. Goods should be entering Gaza through other border crossings that are generally with Israel, not with Egypt. Israel is also prohibiting the provision of food purchased on the Israeli market, so the aid agencies have to bring it from Egypt, which is even more difficult. Plus, there are also many restrictions on the ability to distribute it once it actually gets in to the Gaza Strip. And then we see these awful images of desperate people charging these provision convoys that are coming in and taking what they can because they are simply so desperate and the food isn't reaching some areas of Gaza. So you have a situation where in some areas of Gaza, things are only just bad, whereas in others, things are just absolutely atrocious. And this is not a very large area. So certainly, and I think it's recognized now by the international community, the Israeli government is at fault, is responsible for this. And this should lead to immediate international action, not simply conversations with Israeli policymakers, but actually clear clarifications that Israel is violating both its legal obligations, i.e., this is a war crime, and also that this is simply an immoral way to treat a civilian population.
After a visit to the Rafah crossing between Egypt and Gaza, U.S. Democratic Senators Jeff Merkley and Chris Van Hollen blasted the Israeli process for screening the aid. Senator Van Hollen spoke to CBS Face the Nation. This is what he said.
Many items that should be allowed to go into Gaza, water sort of filtration systems, other systems like that, were in a warehouse of rejected items that we visited. While we were there, we saw a truck turned away that had a big box from UNICEF, which is, of course, the UN organization that helps children. It was a unit to help with water desalinization. It was is rejected. And when one item on a truck is rejected, the entire truck is rejected. The other big issue is within Gaza. The so-called deconfliction process, which is just a fancy name for those who are providing humanitarian assistance to have the confidence that they can deliver it without being killed.
If you can talk more about this, Sarit. Again, the senator, Van Hollen, is the one who has also called for release of more information about the Israeli sniper who murdered Shireen Abu Akleh on May 11, 2022, in Jenin, in the occupied West Bank.
Yeah, absolutely, Amy. Well, we certainly appreciate the leadership that Senator Van Hollen and actually Senator Merkley are showing on this issue. And it is absolutely crucial that U.S. lawmakers, both from the more progressive part of the Democratic Party, but also from the mainstream security-oriented, kind of more established part of the Democratic Party, are engaging with President Biden to demand action on this issue. Simply an unconscionable situation that is unfolding in front of us. Now, I'd like to refer to the second part of Senator Holland's discussion of the dangers inside of Gaza. Yes, absolutely. There's been another update by the office of the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs discussing an additional rejection by the Israeli authorities of another attempt to coordinate the transfer of medical goods into hospitals in the northern Gaza Strip. This was only the day before yesterday, apparently. So we're seeing that there are simply so many difficulties in trying to bring the aid, deliver the aid with safety for the aid providers, obviously, in this area that is bombed. And this brings us to the essential issue, which is that there needs to be a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. There needs to be a halt to Israeli airstrikes and bombardments in order for this food and aid and assistance, and not only food, medical supplies and other necessities have to be provided. And this is one, the continuation of the hostilities is making this provision far too dangerous and impossible currently. This is one other a reason why we need this to stop. B'Tselem has called for a ceasefire. But, of course, the most important reason for this to stop is to stop the killing of civilians, of women and children and human beings in the Gaza Strip in a way that absolutely is disproportionate to what is facing Israel right now. And to the policies of, you know, basically airstrikes, bombing residential homes, all of this is one, you know, is and the huge death toll, 23,000 Gazans and counting, as a result, you know, that can only be described as a revenge attack after the horrific death toll that Israelis have suffered. But, we simply cannot accept, it's certainly not moral and it's certainly not legal that we inflict such a degree of suffering on Gazans, we Israelis, regardless of how much we have suffered and how horrific we have been affected by this. There is simply no justification for the continuation of this Israeli attack on Gaza, and it has to stop. There has to be a ceasefire.
Sarit, I wanted to ask you, you're talking to us from Tel Aviv. How aware are Israelis of the catastrophic situation so close to where most of them live? And is there any significant portion of the population that cares?
Well, unfortunately, Juan, the situation is very, very depressing and just painful when we look at the responses of many Israelis, possibly even the majority of Israelis, to what we see now in Gaza. I think the majority of Israelis still support what we are doing there. There is very little protest or a very little rejection of the methods that Israel is employing in its attack against the civilian population of Gaza. The Israeli media doesn't really broadcast much information about the suffering of Gazans, the devastation, the utter devastation of infrastructure, and the loss of homes, and the human beings are being killed on a daily basis, on an hourly basis. But one of the saddest aspects of this is that even when people are aware of it, there are so many politicians and influencers and people who are simply rejecting any need to respect the humanity of people in Gaza. And unfortunately, some of the people who are aware of the huge price, the horrific toll that Gazans are paying, are not, simply okay with it. And this is one of the most depressing aspects of what is going on now in terms of the, you know, total dehumanization of Gazans in among many people in Israel. There are, I should mention, there are Israelis who are opposed to this situation. There are Israelis who are calling to recognize the humanity of Gazans, but we are in the minority, unfortunately.
Yeah, we have less than a minute left, but I wanted to ask you quickly. You've also been monitoring the violence in the West Bank that has gotten far less attention. Could you talk about what you've chronicled?
Absolutely, yes. So since October 7th, there has also been a massive increase in the violence by Israeli soldiers and also security forces and Israeli settlers against Palestinians in the West Bank. It has led to a really large number of Palestinians killed by soldiers and by Israeli settlers. It has led to takeovers of land by settlers, to the removal, to the forcible transfer of Palestinian herding communities from very large parts of the West Bank. It's led to the, you know, the total destruction of the olive harvest, for example. As a coordinated campaign by settlers to damage the Palestinian economy. And all of these things are happening with very little international attention. And again, this has got to end. There has to be a recognition of what is going on throughout the West Bank, of Israeli actions there, and how, and as we call when it comes to the situation in the Gaza Strip, there has to be international action to hold Israeli policymakers accountable for their decisions that have led to these horrific results.
I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to South Carolina, where President Biden delivered his second campaign speech of the year at the historic Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, where in 2015, 8 black parishioners and their pastor were shot dead by a white supremacist. Biden remembered the victims.
On June 17, 2015, the beautiful souls, 5 survivors and 5 survivors, invited a stranger into this church to pray with them. The word of God was pierced by bullets and hate, of rage, propelled by not just gunpowder, but by a poison. Poison that has for too long haunted this nation. What is that poison? White supremacy. Oh, it is. It's a poison. Throughout our history, it's ripped this nation apart. This has no place in America. Not today, tomorrow, or ever.
As he
That's all right. That's all right.
As he spoke, Biden was disrupted by activists demanding a Gaza ceasefire.
Without light, there's no path from this darkness.
If you really care about the lives lost here, then you should honor the lives lost and call for a ceasefire in Palestine.
Ceasefire! Ceasefire! Ceasefire!
As the protesters were removed from the church, supporters of President Biden began chanting 4 more years. He addressed the protesters.
I understand their passion, and I've been quietly working. I've been quietly working with the Israeli government to get them to reduce and significantly get out of Gaza. I'm using all that I can to do.
Without naming Donald Trump, Biden blasted the former president and leading 2024 Republican candidate as a loser who tried to overthrow the 2020 election results by urging his supporters to storm the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. A number carried Confederate flags and wore white supremacist and far-right symbols. Following the massacre at the Emanuel AME Church in 2015,
following the mass funeral at the University of Charleston Arena that thousands came out for. Our next guest, Bree Newsom Bass, scaled the 30-foot flagpole at the South Carolina State Capitol and removed the Confederate flag. As police officers shouted at her to come down, she shimmied to the top of the flagpole, took the flag in her hand and said, "You come against me with hatred. I come against you in the name of God. This flag comes down today."
You come against me with hatred and oppression and violence. I come against you in the name of God. This flag comes down today.
While Bree Newsom was arrested along with an ally, it was only after this action that the Confederate flag was formally removed from the South Carolina Statehouse grounds. Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley was governor of South Carolina at the time. She has faced fresh backlash after she didn't mention slavery when asked about the cause of the U.S. Civil War during a recent town hall in New Hampshire. Well, for more, we're joined in Raleigh, North Carolina, by Bree Newsom Bass, artist, anti-racist activist. Bree, welcome back to Democracy Now! This certainly does take us back. As people debate whether it was Nikki Haley who ultimately forced the flag to come down, we're going to the woman who actually took it down and risked your freedom to do it. Talk about why you did that then. Ultimately, the legislature would vote to take it down, and how you feel about what's happening today.
Yes, and thank you again so much for having me on. I want to make it clear, yes, I did scale the pole and take the Confederate flag down. This was an issue that people had been protesting for years and years and years. And that's part of what made it so egregious in 2015 when we had the massacre at Emanuel AME and South Carolina refused to lower the flag, because part of the reason why they were refusing to lower the flag is that they had passed a law in the year 2000 saying that it couldn't be lowered for any reason after they moved it from the Capitol Dome to the flagpole on the lawn where it was at the time that I took it down. So this had been going on for years and years and years. And Nikki Haley actually opposed taking the flag down right up until those massacres occurred and the mounting political protest and the, you know, the pressure made it where she basically had to, at that point, support the flag coming down. So ideologically, she has never really had this stance of being opposed to either the Confederacy or, symbols of the Confederacy, and certainly not opposed to racist policy. She went right from the governorship to serving in the Trump administration. And she's had a number of incidents over the years where the things that she says or the things that she does directly contradict with her, you know, her claim of having led the way on taking the Confederate flag down. At one of her recent rallies, she played that song, Find Out in a Small Town, you know, the song that people really raised a lot of concern about because it was obviously alluding to sundown towns and the racial violence that Black people have experienced here for decades and decades and decades. So this is not new for Nikki Haley. It just shows that she does not really represent anti-racism in any real way.
And Bree, I'd like to ask you, in response to President Biden's speech, you posted on social media, quote, "How the Black church is used as a prop for white politicians actually proves the point that racism is alive and well and strong." Could you expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I think that the whole way that the incidents in 2015, both the massacre at Emanuel AME, refocus on the Confederate flag there in South Carolina, the formal ceremony around taking the flag down, and the way that American politics returns to those moments again and again and again, speaks to how relevant it still is. The fact that Black churches are frequently used as, political campaign stops for politicians. In this case with Joe Biden, You know, he is clearly trying to make an appeal, not just to black voters, but really trying to fend off criticism that he is racist, that he is sponsoring a genocide. And that criticism is completely well-founded because he is sponsoring a genocide. And genocide is the most extreme form of racial violence that there is. And so to use the pulpit at Emmanuel AME in this manner to make it a prop essentially for Joe Biden's re-election bid, to me, is the greatest assault on truth. I know Joe Biden stood there in the pulpit and said that there is an assault on truth that's happening right now. Joe Biden is in many ways leading that assault. And I know that he's running against Donald Trump, who we know is also a serial liar. But Donald Trump is not the one who is currently in office right now. It is Joe Biden. And this effort to use the church, not just the black church, but the site of racial violence, of a mass murder, to deflect from the fact that Joe Biden himself is bombing churches, bombing mosques, bombing places of worship, and murdering many civilians, people who have sought shelter in those places. It just exposes the complete hypocrisy of this entire situation and the vacuum of moral leadership at the top. And that's why I took offense to it. I think that's why many people who watched it took offense to it. I'm very glad that the young people stood up and protested, because even though they were few in that audience, they represented the majority of people worldwide.
You know, it's interesting, Bree. The polls that have just come out today indicate that Nikki Haley is surging in the polls in New Hampshire. You referenced where she stood on the Confederate flag. I wanted to go back to 2014, when then South Carolina Republican Governor Nikki Haley suggested South Carolina had resolved its image problem and that having the Confederate flag at the State House was fine because not a single CEO had complained. She was speaking at a gubernatorial debate.
You know, the Confederate flag is a very sensitive issue. And what I can tell you is, over the last 3.5 years, I spend a lot of my days on the phones with CEOs and recruiting jobs to this state. I can honestly say I have not had one conversation with a single CEO about the Confederate flag. What is important here is that we look at the fact that, yes, perception of South Carolina matters. That's why we have everybody answering the phones. It's a great day in South Carolina. That's why we're being named the friendliest state and the most patriotic state and getting all these great accolades. But we really kind of fixed all that when you elected the first Indian American female governor, when we appointed the first African American U.S. senator.
That was Nikki Haley back in 2014. Bree Newsom-Bass, your final comment.
I mean, I think that says it all, right? So, first of all, she's saying that it's okay. The optics are okay, right? We're not talking about the substance. We're not talking about the experience. We're not talking about whether people are actually experiencing equal treatment under the law, just the optics. So the optics are fine because it's not disrupting business, right? And then the other thing that she offers as evidence that everything is okay is the fact that she's non-white. She is an Indian American woman. And then she points to other people in the administration, excuse me, who are non-white. Well, that's the entire problem right there. The idea is that so long as we can keep business going as usual, it doesn't matter that there's violence. It doesn't matter that there's racism. All that matters is the optics. And that is what Nikki Haley's campaign represents in her falsely claiming that she led the way on taking the Confederate flag down. That's what Joe Biden's campaign represents in terms of thinking that all that matters is giving a speech at a church and ignoring all of the churches that are being blown up and all of the Palestinians that are being killed, ignore the fact that young people are demanding a future and we have people who are older who don't seem to care at all that this assault in Palestine is disproportionately affecting children or killing children. And then in the case of Nikki Haley, again, she does not truly represent any of the things that she is claiming when it comes to being anti-racist. You can say whatever words you want to say. You can put together whatever kind of events you want to put together. But the fact is that the truth is going to be the truth. We see what is actually happening. And I support all of the disruptions because the last thing that we need is to carry on business as usual when our democracy is absolutely under attack. Democracy is under attack worldwide. And genocide is the most extreme, form of racial violence that there is. So there's no way that we are fighting white supremacy simply by taking down a flag or having an event at Emmanuel AME. In the midst of genocide, in the midst of doing away with affirmative action, voting rights, the attack on abortion rights. This is where we are at. It's a very dangerous place. And I hope that people look beyond the optics and support those people who are disrupting, because the last thing that we need is to carry on with business as usual.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken's back in the Middle East to meet with leaders across the region. During a stop in Qatar, Blinken warned the war in Gaza could, quote, easily metastasize into a regional war. While Blinken's publicly calling for de-escalation, the Biden administration continues to face criticism for sending more weapons to Israel while carrying out its own attacks in Iraq and Syria, as well as targeting Houthi forces in Yemen. This comes as Israel's bombardment of Gaza has entered its fourth month, as the UN top humanitarian official warns the relentless assault has left Gaza uninhabitable. According to Palestinian health officials, the death toll in Gaza is nearing 23,000, including almost 10,000 children. Israel's attacks continue to take a devastating toll on Palestinian journalists. By one count, at least 100 Palestinian journalists have been killed so far since October 7th. On Sunday, an Israeli airstrike in southern Gaza killed two journalists, Mustafa Thuraya of Agence France-Presse and Hamza Al-Dadou of Al Jazeera. Hamza was the eldest son of Al Jazeera's Gaza bureau chief, Wael Al-Dadou, who'd already lost his wife, daughter, another son and a grandson in an Israeli airstrike in October, and then was wounded in another strike that killed his cameraman, Samer Al Daka. On Sunday, the BBC's Julian Marshall interviewed Israeli spokesperson Elan Levy.
Al Jazeera operating in Gaza legitimate journalists, as far as Israel is concerned?
I'm not sure what standard we're using to measure legitimate journalists. We have intense criticism of Al Jazeera and the way that they have been fueling a lot of violence in this conflict with their incorrect reporting.
Israel, the Israeli government is not a fan of Al Jazeera. Is that what you're saying
to me? Right. We are not big fans of Al Jazeera. That is correct. We much prefer the BBC.
Right. But so you would possibly prefer Al Jazeera not to have a presence in Gaza?
We prefer for Hamas not to have a presence in Gaza.
Well, I'm talking about Al Jazeera. You would prefer Al Jazeera not to have a presence in Gaza.
We would prefer that all media reporting about this conflict be accurate, not spread lies and disinformation in the way that Al Jazeera has been doing.
For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His piece for The Nation is headlined, "Will Israel Drag the U.S. into Another Ruinous War?" Trita, welcome back to Democracy Now! So we're talking to you on the Blinken trip through the Middle East, something like the fifth time he'll be going back to Israel and the West Bank. And when he was in Qatar this weekend and held a news conference, the day he arrived in Qatar, Al Jazeera's reporter, Hamza Al-Dadou, the son of the Gaza bureau chief of Al Jazeera, Wael Al-Dadou, was killed in an airstrike on a car that also killed an AFP reporter. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Well, this is the conflict in which we have seen more journalists being killed than in any other recent conflict. And it increasingly appears as if those are not accidents, but actually targeted, particularly in the case of this journalist. As you mentioned in your program, his family has been targeted, he has been targeted, and now his son has been killed as well. It increasingly looks as if Israel is desiring to make sure that Al Jazeera no longer can operate in Gaza. And it is largely thanks to Al Jazeera that we know so much about what has been happening in Gaza, because they had a presence there from before the war began. So they were already there once the war started. This is a tremendous danger, because with what South Africans are accusing Israel of, and it comes to genocide, not having eyes and ears on the ground there completely changes the pictures in terms of what the Israelis can and cannot do.
And talk about what this means in terms of an escalation, not a de-escalation, although Tony Blinken keeps talking about de-escalation, of a wider war in the Middle East. Why he's in the Middle East, having gone from Turkey and Greece to Qatar, he's going to Saudi Arabia today, to Israel and to the West Bank and beyond.
I think the Biden administration clearly do not want an escalation. They do not want to see a widening of the war. But the approach that they have pursued is one in which they're trying to maximize Israel's ability to continue to bomb Gaza while putting pressure on other actors in the region for them not to escalate. While the administration itself admits that there is no desire in Hezbollah, in Iran, for a wider war. So it's not as if they want that war when it comes to Hezbollah, yet the pressure is supposed to be on them while not putting pressure on the Israelis. This is not going to work in the long run. We've already seen that day by day we're getting closer and closer towards a military confrontation that is much larger than just Gaza. Unless the Biden administration is willing to also put material support on Israel, we will most likely move further into that escalation. And this is what is so perplexing about the Biden administration's position. The fastest and easiest way to actually get a de-escalation is most likely a ceasefire in Gaza. The groups such as Iraqi militias, the Houthis, have made it clear that if there is a ceasefire, they will cease their attacks. Now, we have evidence of that as well, because when there was a ceasefire in the end of November of last year, for 6 days, there were no attacks whatsoever from the Iraqi militias. They completely stopped their attacks. There were 6 attacks the day before the ceasefire. But once there was a ceasefire, they're completely stopped. When it comes to the Houthis, there's only 1 attack during that period that we can attribute to them instead of daily attacks. So we have some clear evidence that if there is a ceasefire, there will be a de-escalation. Yet that is the option that the Biden administration is unwilling to pursue. Instead, it is going around the region asking other countries to put more pressure on Iran, on Hezbollah, on other actors. Some of that pressure is probably quite needed, but in the absence of a ceasefire, it will probably not be effective.
As Tony Blinken, as President Biden calls for a de-escalation, they continue to provide weapons, circumventing Congress twice, providing artillery shells for Israel's bombardment of Gaza. You quote in your Nation piece retired Israeli Major General Yitzhak Brick, who conceded in November, "All of our missiles, the ammunition, the precision-guided bombs, all the airplanes and bombs, it's all from the U.S." Can you talk further about this, this contradiction between what the U.S. is saying and actually how much power it has? Give us a history lesson in the past, going back to President Reagan and Lebanon, when the U.S. says stop.
The Biden administration, I think, has been pushing a narrative that essentially says that Biden doesn't have the leverage, the U.S. doesn't have the leverage to be able to stop this. It doesn't seem to be compatible with reality, because as you pointed out, the Israeli Major General himself admits that all of these weapons are coming from the United States. And if the U.S. were to put a stop to these shipments, then the Israelis would not be able to continue this fight for much longer. So the question is not whether the U.S. has leverage. It clearly does. The question is whether Biden is willing to use it. And so far, he has not been willing to use it, because he's actually buying into supporting the Israeli objective of completely defeating Hamas. He seems to want to see Israel do to Hamas what the U.S. couldn't do to the Taliban. But we have historical examples. In 1982, when Israel went into Lebanon and the Reagan administration started to become increasingly concerned about this and viewed it as being detrimental to U.S. interests, eventually Ronald Reagan, both publicly and in a private conversation with Menachem Begin, essentially told him, you have to stop, otherwise I'm going to freeze the shipments of F-16 airplanes to Israel. Within 20 minutes, Menachem Begin called back and ordered a retreat of the Israelis out of Lebanon. We have clear examples in the past in which pressure, particularly public pressure, actually has been effective. The reason why Biden is not using it is because he's bought into the Israeli objective.
I mean, all the polls in the United States show the overwhelming number of young voters are opposed to his position right now when it comes to Israel and the West Bank, people of color as well. Can you explain, as a person who understands a lot about what goes on inside the Beltway, why Biden is refusing to in any way stand up, not just signal on the outside calling for de-escalation, but actually making those calls, since he's had, to say the least, so many with Netanyahu?
I think the Biden administration made a huge miscalculation from the outset. They did not think that there would be this type of a backlash amongst the American public, including his own supporters, against the Israeli campaign. Now, when it has happened, it appears that the conclusion in the White House is that they have already lost these votes. They will not be able to gain them back if they shift their position. But if they shift their position, they will likely lose some of the voters that are in support of Israel's campaign. That calculation, however, seems to leave out a very important component, which is that there's also another block of voters, a block of voters that have not yet given up on Biden. But if this war continues, as it now appears that it will, and particularly if it enlarges and drags the U.S. into it, then Biden also risks losing that block. And if that block is larger than the block of voters who support Israel's campaign, then Biden is compounding his initial miscalculation by further undermining his own ability to get reelected.
The Iraqi government is blasting the United States after a U.S. drone strike in Baghdad killed a top commander in an Iran-backed militia in Iraq. On Friday, the Iraqi government announced plans to expel U.S.-led forces from Iraq. Can you talk about the significance of this treaty?
This is very important because this is highly problematic for the Iraqi government. The Iraqi government has tried to walk a fine balancing act. They wanted to keep a certain degree of U.S. military presence in Iraq, at least for the next few years, while at the same time balancing that against the pressure from Iraqi militias and others who want to see the U.S. leave. Once the U.S. is now actually assassinating leaders of those militias inside of Iraq, in the previous weeks, those attacks were taking place in Syria. Now they've also started to take place in Iraq itself. This is highly problematic. It's a violation of Iraq's sovereignty, according to the Iraqi government, and it further increases the pressure on the Iraqi government to ask the U.S. to leave, which I believe will happen relatively, in the next years or so. It will happen. It's not sustainable to have the U.S. troops there. Ultimately, from a U.S. perspective, I think that's actually a good thing. Those troops in Iraq are essentially sitting ducks, and they're targets of these Iraqi militias. You take those troops out, and the Iraqi militias don't have targets to shoot at, and as a result, the tripwire for the U.S. to get dragged into war, at least that one, will be removed.
Let me ask you, as we wrap up, a suspected Israeli strike in southern Lebanon has killed a senior commander in an elite unit of Hezbollah earlier today, in a move that further escalates tension in the region. The significance of this, from Iraq to southern Lebanon, Trita.
So you have three major fronts in which the risk of escalation is significant. Of course, you have the Red Sea with the Houthis attacking ships. You have the Iraqi militias and Syrian militias targeting U.S. troops. And then you have the desire of the Israelis to expand the war into Lebanon and try to take out Hezbollah as well. The last one is getting really heated up right now. The attack this morning is yet another one. There has already been a bit of a shooting war, but it's at lower level between Israel and Hezbollah ever since the start of the war after October 7th. But it is escalating, and it's getting deeper into both Israeli and Lebanese territory. One of the things that I think is highly problematic in the way that the mainstream media has covered this is that it talks about how Biden is grappling with how to avoid an escalation of this war. And I genuinely believe that the Biden administration doesn't want that. But these reports don't seem to mention that the demand of some of these groups is a ceasefire. And if there is a ceasefire, they would also then de-escalate their attacks on U.S. troops, etc. Now, the reporting doesn't have to say that this is what is going to happen. It should be scrutinizing these statements by the Houthis and the Iraqi militias. But at a minimum, it needs to mention that that is their demand so that the American public is aware that it appears to exist an option for de-escalation through a ceasefire. The fact that it is not mentioned in most mainstream media is highly problematic because it leaves the public with the wrong impression that the only way Biden can de-escalate is by further escalating the situation, by increasing the deterrence and attacking, whether it's the Houthis or the Iraqi militias. The option of actually going for a ceasefire to de-escalate doesn't seem to be mentioned in the mainstream media, and that's a major mistake, I think.
Trita Parsi, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We'll link to your piece in The Nation. Will Israel drag the U.S. into another ruinous war? We were just talking about Lebanon. The Reuters reporter, Isam Abdullah, was also killed there. Reuters did an investigation saying it was an Israeli artillery strike that killed him. More than 100 Palestinian journalists have died since October 7th. We've reported two more journalists in Gaza were killed in an Israeli airstrike this weekend. Among the victims, the eldest son of Al Jazeera's Gaza bureau chief, Wael al-Dadu, just a few months ago, in October, he also lost 12 family members, including his wife, his 15-year-old son, his 7-year-old daughter, and his infant grandson in an Israeli airstrike. Like his father, Hamza al-Dadu worked for Al Jazeera. He was 27 years old. Hamza was reportedly driving in a car with other journalists on a road in Khan Yunis when the vehicle was hit. The freelance journalist Mustafa Thuraya, who was a stringer for Agence France-Presse, AFP, was also killed, while a third, Hazem Rajab, was seriously injured. A video showed Wael al-Dadu crying next to his son's body, holding his hand. Wael spoke on Sunday.
How can someone receive the death of their oldest son and everything in my life after I lost some of my family members, my wife, son Mohammed, and Shem, and Adam? How can I receive this? The world must see with their own eyes and not with Israel's eyes. It must listen and watch all that is happening to the Palestinian people. What has Hamza done to them? And what has my family done to them? What have civilians in Gaza Strip done to them? They have not done anything. The world is blinded by what is going on in Gaza.
Just last month, Wael al-Dadu was injured in an Israeli drone attack while covering the aftermath of an Israeli strike on a UN school sheltering displaced people in Khan Yunis. His cameraman, Al Jazeera photojournalist Samer Abu Duka, bled to death over the course of more than 5 hours as Israeli forces reportedly prevented rescue workers and ambulances from reaching Samer. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate says Israel's killed at least 102 journalists in Gaza since October 7th. For more, we go to the West Bank. We're joined by Anan Khusmar, a Palestinian journalist volunteer at the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate, which has filed an amicus brief in support of the Center for Constitutional Rights genocide lawsuit against Israel, citing the unprecedented number of Palestinian journalists killed in Gaza, saying they've been deliberately targeted for assassination by the Israeli military. Anan, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the journalists who were killed this weekend? Al Jazeera's Hamza al-Dadu, amazingly killed on the day that Blinken arrived in Qatar. Qatar owns Al Jazeera. Mustafa Thuraya of Agence France-Presse. And then put them in the broader context of how many Palestinians. We've not seen this any time in war. More than 100 Palestinian journalists, estimates from 70 to over 100, dead since October 7th.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you very much for having me to speak about this, for us, very, very important issue. Hamza Dahdouh and Mustafa Abu Thraya are just the latest victims of Israel's calculated and deliberate assassination campaign against Palestinian journalists that has been going on for the last 3 months. Unfortunately, every time we release a number, we have to update it within hours. Sometimes. Our investigations so far of the 109 journalists up to this moment that have been killed by Israel's genocidal military campaign indicates that at least 96 of those were deliberately and specifically targeted by surgical Israeli strikes against them at home or in the line of duty. 22 of those were killed in the night of duty using sniper fire, drones, and surgical airstrikes, similar to the one that took place yesterday that took the life of the two journalists. They were targeted in their car. The munition that was used was big enough to damage the car and kill everybody inside, but it didn't hurt anybody around, and they were targeted at a moment where there was nobody close to the vehicle at the time, so it's clearly indicating that they were specifically targeted. Other than this, there is at least 74 cases of journalists that were killed at home, specifically in strikes that specifically hit their flats. Some of them are in big apartment blocks where they are on the fifth or sixth floor and their flat is targeted, and no damage to any or limited damage to other nearby flats or homes. And in the remaining 13 cases, we were just not able to determine who exactly was the person targeted in the strike. So, for example, we excluded any cases where more than 10 people were killed. We excluded cases where people who were not at the flat or at the location were the journalists. So there is an element of, you know, what Israel likes to call collateral damage. We've also excluded from the 96 that we suggest were at least 96 specifically targeted cases like Akram Shafi'i, who a couple of days ago passed away because he was not allowed or he had no access to adequate health care. Excuse me. And at least at the moment, there is 25 of our journalists are in similar life-threatening situations because of lack of access to medical health care. Also, the wider context of what's happening now is an indication that these journalists are being targeted. As the previous guest alluded to, Israel's interest is to shut down the coverage. And our journalists are a main portal and have played a key role in uncovering the ongoing military campaign by Israel. Other than this, many of our journalists received direct and indirect threats and incitement against them that they had personally reported either publicly or privately to us due to fear that these publication of such reports or threats would actually escalate the situation and put them higher up in the bank of targets for Israel.
You've said that 9% of all Palestinian journalists in the Gaza Strip have been killed since October 7th, and that you feel that press freedom organizations around the world have let Palestinian journalists down. How?
After 190 journalists have been killed, we're still hearing the same statements that are calling for investigations. There are clear patterns. Yes, we haven't been able to establish every single case, but I am sorry, but 3 months into a genocidal campaign that has made Palestinian journalists a primary target for them, 9% of our journalists in Gaza have been killed. This is 8 points higher than the average across the Gaza Strip. I talked about the threats and the specific targeting, and we're still hearing the same thing. I think if press freedom organizations are satisfied at the level of reaction and outrage that they've shown, let alone the action that could actually save the lives of Palestinian journalists, then we should question even the very purpose of their existence, if that's the best they can do and say.
Finally, can you explain the lawsuit of the Center for Constitutional Rights that you have filed an amicus brief on behalf of the Palestinian journalists, the significance of this and what this would mean?
This lawsuit aims to block any further diplomatic and military support to Israel. It's just one step, one of many things that we are trying. But unfortunately, this assassination campaign has continued, and we've seen it as part of a wider escalation of use of violence against Palestinian journalists, also in the West Bank. Not only journalists, also medics. We have, since the last 3 months, 47 Palestinian journalists in the West Bank have been arrested. 33 of them are still in prison, 18 of them under administrative detention, and the rest haven't been faced with any charges at all. This level of escalation of use of force is seen is also in regular incursions where the Israeli army targets medical staff and journalists. For example, there has been, where I am in Tulkarem, regular incursions that have an emerging pattern of trying to maintain continued presence and curfew over Palestinian cities, almost as a practice in order for the eventuality of needing to control such cities for extended period of times, like I explained. And the focus of these attacks is collective punishment, digging out, for example, in Tulkarem, the water pipes to cut the water from the locals, shooting at the electricity grid to cut the electricity. And also all of this comes with a huge price on our local institutions that Israel is trying to destroy. And this also goes back to the attack on Palestinian journalists in Gaza. If you look at the profiles of those who are targeted, you see that they are not just targeted for being journalists, they're being targeted for being an important part of the social fabric. Our famous journalists in Gaza are not what you would expect from an elite journalist sitting outside. These are humble people who have been the foundations of our society for a long time. And alongside our journalists, there's been lecturers, for example, most media lecturers and journalism lecturers who are also reported as journalists being killed, but they are actually media lecturers as well. And we've had heads of universities targeted, poets, and you name it. So the one needs to look at the Israeli bank of targets seriously and the deliberate nature of this. And I would like to end with, I think one of the most striking things is when you speak to Palestinian journalists in Gaza, they never complain about their own suffering or what they've been going through as journalists. They literally want to continue to do their work to the last drop of their blood in order to bring an end to this, to stop the genocide.
Anan Khosmar, I want to thank you so much for being with us, a Palestinian journalist with the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate, speaking to us from Tal Quram in the occupied West Bank.
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity radio show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
We got a lot to say. free to ask one of our friendly staff. New shipments arrive every week. We're always expanding our selection here at Phoenix, Avenue CKET 90.3 FM. Enjoy your shopping experience.
Hello and welcome to Venus Radio. You just heard a fun little introduction from the origins of this show in 1999. We are on air in Montreal at CKUT 90.3 FM from 12 to 2 EST every Thursday, but you can always check out our archives or listen to us live at ckut.ca. Stay tuned to hear my curated selection of music by women and queer folks. I'm Carissa, by the way. Let's start off with an old favorite of mine, Good Bait by Nina Simone.